Well, it is a great pleasure this week to have Abby Hook, and if the boot is on the other foot, Abby, because of course you work and you have been at KMTV for, I'm guessing, about 2 years now.
Yeah, so 18 months full-time, an intern before that while I was in my last year studying. But yeah, 18 months full-time.
And I'm always really impressed at how you have all this energy, everyone on the team, perhaps doing the sort of thing that I wish I'd done when I left university, because I'm sort of like coming in now and, you know, doing the film programme and appearing on Kent Tonight to talk about film. But where does your sort of energy come from for all of this?
Gosh, that's a good question. Pure grit and determination to wake up and get up when... I mean, it's such a... Anyone will tell you journalism is a busy job. TV is a busy job and a demanding one. You need all of it. You need visuals, you need sound, you need everything. It's so demanding, TV. So it does take a lot. But I think you've got to love it to do it. And you've got to be really excited when... It's really hard to give an anecdote of how small things matter when you're working in TV, but simply when someone's presenting, maybe I'm in the gallery, so behind the scenes, and they start talking about a certain type of bird, and at the same time we put up the correct pictures of that bird, and it's so silly and it sounds so small, but that, like, I cheer in the gallery, because those are the moments where you think, great, that looks perfect. On the output, anyone watching at home just watches it seamlessly, but that's when you know TV's good, when you watch it and you don't notice anything. It's only when it goes wrong where you notice TV's not so seamless. So all them little things that go into making it look seamless is what keeps the audience and attracts it. But the energy I get to do it, I it must come from just loving the type of job and loving TV and being on TV.
Because you have a drama background, don't you?
Yeah. So I, growing up, I did a lot of drama, a lot of theatre, drama at home, drama at a club, whatever the drama was. My dad will tell you that I'm dramatic. If he's going to describe me in one word, sorry, it'll be dramatic. But yeah, drama was something I loved. I did it at school. I was always making my family get involved in different plays and stuff. I was also always making my classmates get involved in plays. Did drama at school, but then at college I studied theatre, English, literature and language, and law. And when you think about it, those are the three components of journalism. So by mistake, without knowing, because I didn't want to go into journalism, didn't really care for it at all, those three actually make a perfect sort of storm, I suppose, for journalism, which is quite strange.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that because we had a guest on the film programme this very day who has an arts degree in history but does all this fighting on set. Not actually do the fighting himself, but choreograph the fighting. And so, but interesting that he has a background that no one else who does what he does has got. And I suppose my background is in religious studies and theology. So I think sometimes when you're doing something that occupies that hinterland space, when you're doing something that isn't the obvious career fit, it kind of means that you walk into a room and maybe other people have got media backgrounds, journalism backgrounds, but you have something a little bit extra, a little bit more bespoke, maybe a bit more quirky, which means that there are certain jobs that you're really a good fit for because you come with that background and that baggage, if you like. So in a way, I guess sometimes not having a very pinpointed model of, you know, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a journalist, and then if you don't do that, then there's no plan B, probably means that you have more flexibility.
Yeah, I suppose so. And I think another thing to add on to that, by finding your niche and doing something really niche, studying... So, when you go to university, you can study something that's really particular, that's really just factors into that one degree, and it will teach you transferable skills. All degrees will, because it's university, it's degrees, it's living on your own, it's all of that. But different degrees will open up more. So, learning journalism, having a degree in journalism, I learn not only if we talk about particular things that are tangible, like print, radio, online, TV, also all those skills within that, the personable skills that could then be transferred into all sorts of different careers. There was so much I learned, and I think that's a huge part of my personality as well, because I absolutely love learning. That's one of the key things about me, I would say, is that I've actually come to realise more recently that I've done it for so long and not really thought, it's just the way I am. But if I'm thinking about myself, looking back, being nostalgic and thinking about who I am, it all comes from this love of learning. And that's why I get involved in some weird and wonderful things. And why I have so many parts of my life that I love. So, you know, you look at me and I'm on this at this local TV station and doing this, but behind the scenes at the weekends, I'll go remote control car racing with my dad and film that. My mum used to go skydiving, so I'd go and watch her do that. With my dad, we used to race hovercrafts. Like, what 13-year-old racing a hovercraft? And you, all these things that behind the scenes you wouldn't know. But I think that huge sense of adventure, learning, adapting, and discovering something new, also being very impatient and getting bored easily, that I get from my dad.
Yeah, and I was just reflecting on this because when I was at university 30-odd years ago, if you saw your lecturer in the supermarket, that felt weird. It's like, do they do their own shopping?
Yeah.
You know, because you see them outside of the space. And I guess it must be the same for you in some ways, because people obviously see the public face because you appear on local TV. But often, of course, and this is what I found particularly for social media, is that I put myself in places that it would have been inconceivable for someone of a different generation to be doing, not just because we didn't have podcasts or we didn't have Facebook 30-odd years ago, but just the fact that, you know, often you were defined by your title or your job. If you were a professor of something or, you know, somebody who teaches students, there were always and necessarily boundaries there. But something has changed, I think, a lot in that time. And I think that maybe I realised there was a point where I thought, I don't really want my epitaph to be, you know, Chris Leacy theologian, because I thought, well, that's one facet of what I do, but probably one that only students who've ever been taught by me would recognise. There has to be something else that you wake up for in the morning.
I find myself obsessed with not having people know me for just one thing. I feel this, like, need to tell people, oh, I do this too, and I do that, and I not only because I want to relate to each person I meet and speak to, but because I want them to know that I would go and do anything. And it's weird when people say, "Oh, you shouldn't care what other people think of you." I know I do. I don't let it control me. Depends on the day. We feel differently day to day, but I do care what people think of me, and I want to create meaningful connections with people, and I want to relate to people. So I find it really important to when I explain my job, for instance, someone says, "What do you do?" I could say, "I'm an assistant news editor." I could say, "Oh, I work in TV." I could say, "I'm a journalist." But I'm always thinking, what hat do I need to have on for this conversation with this person? What should I say that will be cool, will impress them? What will be interesting? You know, when do I tell someone that I skateboard on the weekends and I roller skate and I love sports and I've grown up around motorsport and love that too? And when do I say that at home I build a mini bookshelf and I make books and I have that up at home and I spent hours and hours and hours on that, you know, and I love reading and I love learning, I want to learn another language, like all of these sorts of things. I'm constantly thinking, what hat do I need to wear with this person? But at the same time, just trying to be you, it's a very odd conception, and perhaps something I've never actually said out loud before.
Well, but this is the thing, isn't it? Because one of my worst fears is being defined by somebody else in a way that doesn't adequately represent you. Because if you do something quirky and, you know, people know that you do that, then it's fine, because, you know, that's the side that people see, that in some way you project that.
But you can't control that.
Yeah.
Someone told me that once a long time ago, that you will never be able to change or control, more control, I suppose, what someone else thinks of you. So it's also worth not worrying. And that's why I think I want to present myself because once I've done that, they're going to think something of me. And there's part of me that goes, I know that I've presented myself how I wish. So whatever you take from that is fine.
But it also works the other way, because sometimes if you present yourself in the way that you want to be seen, then people kind of can decide whether to accept it, to reject it.
Yeah.
I mean, often I think, you know, if I've been on live TV for 3 minutes, then, you know, I love projecting that and saying, look what I've just been talking about and so on. And, you know, some people are interested. A lot of the time, my own children sometimes will just be like, you know, they're not as interested as perhaps I would have been at their age. In a different age when media, particularly radio, I think for me growing up, sort of mattered more. There were fewer stations, so it was more of a thing. And I think that's that sort of transition, that sometimes when you're defining the narrative, or maybe you're putting, like you mentioned, the skateboarding, if you're putting those kind of things on social media, or you're happy to talk about them, then in a way, there's no sense that people might sort of be talking behind your back in the sort of, or misrepresent where you're coming from, because there is just that sense that you can say, I'm proud of what I do, but here I am in my own words doing that.
Yeah.
And you kind of then find, and this is what I found, is that people don't then ask too many prying questions, because they say, well, you know, if you want to know what you're doing, we can find out if we want to. It's when they don't know what you do, or people then think, God, he goes to the cinema every night or something like that. You know, they think, why would he do something like that? But in a way, there's, you know, plenty of people who like, but we know that you do that because we followed you on that journey.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how you can be in media, but then still sort of feel that you've got a lot more to project than what is simply on Kent Tonight every evening.
Yeah. Also trying to get your personality across while you're presenting hard news. If I'm talking about a murder investigation, how do I come across as Abby? That's something the channel director's always telling me to do, and it's an incredibly hard skill to learn, and I'm so early in my career trying to learn that kind of thing. But you mentioned social media there. I suppose if you were to look at my social media, you'd get a glimpse of who I am for sure. A lot of it is showing the highlights. With every single social media profile, that's something we all have to remember, and that message is pushed so much now that just when you look at it, huge pinch of salt, and understand that that is not your everyday. It's certainly not my everyday, but that's who I would love to be always. That's my profile on social media, is these are the best moments of my life when I'm feeling great and I'm doing cool things, and this is the picture that I love to look at. I also use social media as a timeline of my life. If I'm ever flicking through Instagram, if I look at my profile, I scroll down to the bottom and I remember all these really cool moments, and I see it like a bit of a log and a bit of a diary in that sense. I'm not great with Facebook, believe it or not. My mum tells me off every day because I'm rubbish at Facebook. My nan does it better than me. I can't do Facebook. So there's different social media platforms. But yeah, if you were to look at it, that's what I think it would be. For me, it's more of a, this is what I'm doing, and these are the bits that I love too.
Yeah. How did the journey start for you? Because am I right in thinking, when I interviewed you on the film programme, I think you said you were from Surrey?
Yeah. So I grew up in a place called Redhill. Actually, funnily enough, lived in somewhere called Caterham first, but that was right at the very beginning when I was really, really tiny. But grew up in Redhill at my mum and dad's house. Sort of, it's like 15, 20 minutes away from Gatwick Airport. That's always the location. But yeah, I grew up there with my mum and dad and my younger brother. He's 2 years younger than me. And when I was 10, that's when my parents split up. And then I always say, from when I was about 10 to about 18, me, my brother and my mum moved about 10 times. We just were from different flats for no particular reason. We just went from different places. Leases were up and we moved. Different people came into our lives and we'd move around and stuff. I also, a huge part of my upbringing is we lived with my mum and my stepdad at the time with my nan and granddad, and that was great because my cousins lived there as well. So two older boy cousins, my younger brother, a stepbrother, my stepdad, my mum, my nan and granddad. It was great. There was always someone in the house, and my nan and granddad are a huge part of bringing me up. I don't have grandparents on my dad's side. They passed away before I was born. They still have a huge impact on our lives and the memories of them that I'm told. But my nan and granddad are huge. They are just another set of parents. Me and my boyfriend always joke, between us, we have 8 parents. That's not including our grandparents, our aunties, aunts, all those, but between us, there are 8 parents within our step parents, because we all get on with all of them really well. We're very fortunate.
This is that thing about templates, isn't there? The sort of the way that, I mean, my parents have been married for 56 years.
Wow.
And, you know, you look at that and think, wow, you know, and all around, you know, sometimes you see that, you know, people's lives don't always go the way you want them to. But actually, this is the thing, is what you learn along the route. You mentioned, you know, the importance of learning. I always used to find when I took my children to nursery that, you know, meeting some of the other parents, those sort of 2-minute conversations that you have, when suddenly you pick up on all the little things that, you know, you suddenly realise how much you have in common, and you suddenly just sort of find those precious.
And think about those eight different parents that I have that I speak to every other weekend when we try and divvy up the weekends and the days to see everybody. Yeah. We try and get it all in, but pockets of life experience and memories with all them different parents. My stepmom, she's Slovakian, so that's a whole nother Eastern European way of looking at life, and she's great, she's hilarious. We get on so well, we're really, really close. And then my stepdad as well, married to my mum, like both him and my mum have suffered brain injuries. So they've got a whole different roller coaster and different life. But he's great. I get on with him so well. We laugh and we joke. We real sort of Mickey taking relationship. And then on the other side with my boyfriend's parents and step parents and family are so welcome with open arms. We are really fortunate, and that yes, that we don't, our parents aren't together, and it's a bit difficult seeing everybody, and it's strained when you look at it. We've got 8 individual people that would do anything for either of us. It's a very fortunate position to be in, I would say.
Yeah, I'm a big believer, it's a term, I think I invented it, called retrospective causality, which means that you look back and sometimes think, oh, it was meant to be, or things, you know, you couldn't have planned it better. But at the time, this is very much linked to the nostalgia work, is that at the time you think this is a horrible experience, or this is dangerous, or this is volatile. I mean, I'm talking to you at a time when there's a lot of insecurity in my profession, and you know, no one quite knows what's around the corner. But in a funny way, it can also be emancipating, because you've got that sense that, you know, those doors that maybe you never thought would open again, you know, now you can sort of knock on them, and legitimately knock on them, and maybe the person on the other side will say, ah, I've been waiting for you all this time, you know, finally you've come. But in your case, having so many family members, you know, as a journalist, you must be picking up as well on so many different ways of navigating those sort of things, which in terms of health, in terms of just general chit-chat, in terms of, you know, the serious things, the light-hearted things, dealing with different ethnicities along the way. That must all form part of this whole tapestry of what it is to be a journalist. When you're going to different places, having to talk to people in maybe a murder scene, or you might be having to talk to the police, or you might have to talk to people who don't necessarily want to be interviewed, and you've got to do this package. You know, you probably have ways in.
I would say a lot of people will look at me and say, how are you so confident? Where does that come from? Everybody, I've had that a lot, and I honestly say my answer is I just pretend. I just walk into a room and just pretend I'm fine. I don't. And I am, because I'm pretending, because I'm just doing it. And then by default, this sense of pretending just becomes you doing it. So I'm not pretending anymore, I am being confident because I'm doing it. It's that like mental block of just, I'll just do it. If you walk through somewhere with confidence, no one's going to stop you. And it's also just being really honest and frank. And it's, I was on a live for a murder, and, you know, just walked over to the policeman, oh, can I get through there, can I come? Because at the end of the day, if you present yourself with, oh, I don't know the knowledge here, please help me, people will help you. And if they don't, they're a bad egg, and you move on. But I don't think there should be any fear in just asking other people, and not being afraid of it being a silly question, just being honest and upfront. And a lot of it is that as journalists, with what we do, everybody thinks, oh, you have to be you have to really know politics, you have to really know the climate emergency, you have to really know sport, you have to really know every story you do. But every day you wake up, you come into this job, you're doing something completely different.
And you don't know what you're going to do.
You don't know what you're going to do. You can't really prepare for anything. So it's about walking into those situations and being like, right, I'm here to report on this story. I'm here to answer the public's questions they would have. So I'm just going to do that. It's not pretending that you know everything. It's pretending you're confident, but upfrontly going, what's going on here? Why are you here today? Like, you've got a local politician visiting something. If you don't know who the politician is, don't really know their background, especially as we're such young journalists as well, just, why is it significant you being here? What are you here doing today? There's obviously research and things you do behind it, but don't pretend to be a master of every single story you ever do. Just rock up and do it, and ask the questions that the public would, because that's your job, you're reporting for the public.
But this is the thing, when you said, for example, that you're filming and the police are over there, so you need to go over to them and ask questions. If you weren't filming, if it was, you know, on your regular weekend, would you then, I mean, obviously you wouldn't be going over in that sort of context, you wouldn't belong there in that sense, you're there because it's part of your job. But does the job afford you a level of confidence that in another context you have? I'll give an example. I can sit on the TV and talk about film for 3 minutes or do a podcast or whatever it is, but I could be in a coffee shop or it could be at the supermarket, and I'm at the till, and then I get asked a question about what do you do, what do you lecture on, and then suddenly, and I've been in this situation enough times to know that you think, oh, you know, I want to swerve this one, because you suddenly go down all sorts of rabbit holes, and suddenly thinking, gosh, I can stand in front of a class of 30 students and be confident and sort of know how to handle all sorts of questions and be aware of the dynamics in the room. But when the boot's on the other foot, and you're in a situation where perhaps somebody else is controlling that narrative, or you're not the person who, you know, it's not your job to steer things in a particular way, then actually sometimes you can be a bit caught off guard. I don't know if that ever happens in your case.
Yeah, I think it gives you... So in that scenario, like walking up to a policeman on my Saturday off and asking, I think I would have, one, interest, because I am a local journalist and I want to know what's going on, and I'm off shift, but I'm going to go and find out because I'm nosy, as is every journalist, professional gossips. But then, two, I think it gives me that, well, I know if he starts asking too many questions, I'll just tell him that I work for a TV station and that's why I'm asking. There also comes a point where you tell someone you're a journalist and they turn their nose up, or they go quiet, or they stop talking. And that actually was the first reaction I ever had a long, long time ago when I was about 14. Someone said to me, Abby, you should be a journalist. And no one had really talked to me about that before. Growing up, we didn't watch the news. I didn't know about local politics. Like, it was so far from anything I could think of. Oh, if you told me, oh, you should be on TV, I'd love to be on TV. But journalism, I didn't really grasp it. The only thing I thought of when I thought of journalism was everyone hates them. I remember that so clearly. This lady saying to me, you'd be a great journalist. And I thought, no, I don't want to be hated. Everyone hates journalists.
But it's that projection, though, isn't it? Because what came to mind when you said that was Princess Diana. And when she died, it was the journalists who, in the first instance, because, you know, as if all journalists are the same, the paparazzi, you know, are the same as the BBC journalists. So almost anybody who had a camera and a microphone was put into that category. So maybe that's what happened.
And that might be from what I've grown up, from what's around me, but it was just never, I don't know why, perhaps the media, films, TV, that's what I'd seen, that journalists were these, like, snidey characters that go in and are nosy and upset people and stuff. But, oh, it's far from the opposite. Yeah, we do upset a few people, but, you know, if you've upset a couple of people, you're probably doing the right thing. You're probably telling the story that needs to be heard. But the amount of times that people say, thank you for sharing my story, I wouldn't, or how elated or happy people are that we're sharing the fact that their bins haven't been collected for 6 weeks. They are thrilled, because it means something, especially in local journalism. The rapport you build up with the people around this area that are recurring guests, give you recurring stories, you realise how much it actually matters. And then, when I'm doing Vox Pops, so when I'm just interviewing strangers on the street, and people come up and go, oh, you're that one on the TV. I'm like, oh, we have a viewer, you know, and he knows, and he watches. Oh yeah, I watch you. Or the guy at the car park where I live at home. If I walk through, he says, oh, I was watching you the other. Like he knew straight away, and that's how close it is. It's the guy that manages the car park, like near where I live, and knows that. And he's going to give you a story, and he's going to be really grateful that his thing got solved, or at least got some attention, at least got some politicians talking. So that's a huge part of it.
But it's accessibility, isn't it? Because that notion of leadership as well. I mean, you know, what makes a good politician? Is it the person who's detached, who knows everything, who's very clever, and maybe in that ivory tower, and they know how to get through a particular, you know, period of turmoil or whatever? Or you have the sort of the bloke that would have a beer with you, you know, the sort of, you know, the person who'd cross over the road and, you know, it's sort of like the guy next door kind of thing. And they both have a place. And actually during lockdown, I think that we had that dynamic, because there was the sense of, you know, do you have, what sort of leader do you need for a particular time where nobody necessarily thought that person would be there to do kind of thing, because, you know, we never quite knew what was around the corner. But that's one of the important things, isn't it? It's being adaptable, it's being flexible. But do you have much contact with the audience in that sense? Because obviously you go into people's homes every evening, but you, by the sound of it, it's to some extent anyway, it's a two-way process, that you know at least some of the audience that you're talking to.
Yeah, it's weird, because I would think, just thinking about it now, that the audience we have now, so the people that are at home watching us, obviously it's a smaller audience than national news. We know that, but sometimes you see them, you bump into them in the street, which is about as close as you'll get to the audience, apart from the people you interview and you meet and their friends and family and whatnot. Those are the people that surprise you. They go, oh, I've seen you on TV. But I would say national news, bigger places like BBC Breakfast will have more of a connection to the audience, in a sense of, if they were to walk down the street, the amount of people that are, but the people flocking, because it's all on our phones now, the people flocking to their, you know, their direct messages, their Instagrams, their Twitter, their X's, their Facebooks, that's where the audience is connecting now as well. It's all digital and online, and that's the sort of feedback you get. But with TV, there's less of a question and answer box, I suppose, when you've, but I do think when it's national, it's weird, but I think there's a closer relationship to the audience than maybe here, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and also because it's reported more, that I get all sorts of quite funny things appearing on my newsfeed sometimes, and it's to do with maybe a guest who'd appeared on some, you know, one of the daily breakfast shows on TV or to an extent radio sometimes. And then, of course, a story is made out of the fact that maybe a guest was a bit rude, or that the presenter was trying to ask a question, didn't get an answer. So suddenly there is that sort of, it's not the way I necessarily would have seen that story. I wouldn't have necessarily accentuated that sort of negative. It might be a really good interview and there's just one sort of difficult question, and I wouldn't necessarily frame the whole thing in that way. But there's clearly an audience who want that kind of, maybe it's salacious, maybe it's a sense of somebody, you know, being put on the spot.
Yeah.
Your favourite presenter who is, you know, suddenly caught out of, you know, their comfort zone.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. In a sense of, that's what makes good TV, it's what makes good social media clips and clicks, it's what perhaps even pushes an audience that wouldn't be watching the breakfast shows to the breakfast shows, because it's now hit social media, it's now viral on TikTok, so that's when you go back to the traditional TV.
So do you think, if you were presenting Kent tonight and then some calamity happened or something really... I mean, I had one moment with you, actually, when I was referring to films from the 90s, and I meant to talk about particular types of thrillers, and afterwards I thought, I can't believe I said that on live TV. But it's kind of funny. But sometimes,
I still laugh about that.
But when you are in that kind of situation, when something... I mean, I actually do think that it brings out the best in oneself. Because if I'm teaching, and sometimes I'm talking for 2 hours, and I'm not getting a vibe that the students are necessarily connected, and I think, gosh, we've got 2 hours. This happened when I was doing something on biblical epics, funny enough, and none of the students had seen a single biblical epic. And I myself would, you know, it wouldn't be my overtly sort of like go-to genre. And I thought, I've got to talk about this for 2 hours. They haven't seen any of these films. Well, you know, but this is, if you like, the curriculum. So, you know, we have to do this. How are we going to do it? And I'd seen Bohemian Rhapsody, the Freddie Mercury story, which follows the same kind of template as the rise and fall of the, you know, the god. Yeah. And I said, who's seen Bohemian Rhapsody? And suddenly, some people were like thinking, yeah, we saw it on Saturday. Why is our lecturer asking us about that? And then that was the way in, because a lot of the Jesus films deal with that notion of celebrity and fame and somebody who rises to great heights and then falls. And I framed the entire... It was a lot of...
Relatable.
And suddenly, that lecture came alive. But I tried that again a few years later, and the students had never seen Bohemian Rhapsody. So I caught them at that moment.
Yeah.
It was just at that moment, there was that point of connection, which, for that particular class, probably would never be repeated.
Yeah. I think there is that weird disconnect. Like, when you're talking about sitting in a room full of students, you have that instant feedback. You know, right, I've been talking about this for 5 minutes. None of them are engaging. Let's switch it up. I don't know. I could do my whole half an hour show and people are like, oh, why is she talking like that? Oh, she's annoying me. Oh, she's too bland. Oh, she's too much. I don't know. I only know from, you know, the gallery that are in my ear that are behind the scenes pressing all the buttons. But, you know, they're so busy on their overall show and the overall output and all the things that go wrong behind the scenes that's not the audience. The audience are those people sitting at home that switch on at 5:30 and go, oh, there's Abby. So, but I don't have that. And I think sometimes I'd prefer maybe a bit more of a... And that's the difference between my drama background and then TV. You get a round of applause at the end of your show. I don't get a round of applause. Yeah. I hear the credits go and I take my earpiece out and have to go home. It's quite... Underwhelming, I would say.
But there is an equivalent to that, isn't there? And as you mentioned, you don't use Facebook, but I will always put out the stuff that I do. And I think because there's so much of it sometimes, you know, it's the law of diminishing returns. Because it's the first time you do it, people think, God, Chris is doing live TV on a Thursday. Yeah. But then after a point, it's like, well, but we know he does that, so we don't need to watch. But when you get the feedback, which is the equivalent, you know, if you're doing a performance on stage, then, you know, people will clap and you'll say, yes, that's wonderful. They're clapping louder than they did last night. This is the audience really like me.
Yeah.
But on Facebook sometimes, or alternative social media sites, you know, you will find people engaging, and sometimes somebody will say something that really cuts to the heart of what you're trying to get out. Because I think there's a reason we do what we do. And, you know, sometimes we do it because we like to publicise ourselves or promote. We like to perform. But often we like to perform because we have a particular skill, and actually in doing that you're kind of making people happy. You know, even like doing the podcast, someone said that it's like sitting on a bus. Actually, it was the best thing anybody could have said. It's like sitting on a bus and you're listening to this, eavesdropping on this conversation of the other people next to you, and you arrive at your stop, but you decide to stay on the bus because you think, I just want to know, where's this conversation going? And I wonder if there's, to an extent, that there's an element of that with what you're doing on TV as well. There's just that sense that you're connecting, and you must sit there sometimes knowing that, you know, it's maybe not the direction of travel that the interview is going in, but you kind of know that something has happened that actually is kind of transformative.
Yeah, there's parts of just relinquishing control of what you planned your questions to be and just going with wherever the story takes, and often it can become a bit more interesting. One springs to mind. I was interviewing a lady about she was doing a charity work, and she was going to movie premieres to get signatures from all the famous people, all the actors and actresses, and then selling them on for charity. And she was just coming on to talk about that, and it was quite a light thing to talk about, end of the show, you know, oh, charity stuff, and you've met all these. And then she started talking about, halfway through the interview, about the strikes in Hollywood and how she was on the last red carpet when the strikes happened and all the actors left the carpet. It's a huge moment in Hollywood, a huge moment. And for Kent TV station to report on it, you know, she was the tie to Kent. The charity was in Kent. She was working for it in Kent. The events were in Kent, selling the stuff, but from Hollywood. And I just, that was a moment where it's like, oh, this is great. This is what it's about, you know. We've come here for a story, and she's given me such an interesting one. And then it meant the next time the strikes were still on again or back again, she'd come back and she was able to talk about it and be like a reoccurring sort of guest in that sense. So there's definitely parts of that which are great. And in terms of like the audience and who I'm speaking to and who I'm reaching, like my nan said something lovely. She said that, she texted me saying, oh, I caught up with you tonight. I like watching you at 5:30 because I feel like I've caught up with you. You know, I don't live near her anymore, and I go back, I try and see her every month or so. But yeah, it's hard when you've got so many family all over and such a busy job. But that was really sweet, and that means a lot to me that she's really content. I know when I sit down, I'm like, she's going to be watching, and she feels like she's caught. She can see me, she can see I'm okay, she can see I'm doing news, and she gets a bit of Kent news. She doesn't live in Kent, but she loves watching it. And like, she told me Grandad only watches to see what outfit she'll wear, so apparently he's like a fashionista in secret. But yeah, and I thought that's such a key part for me personally. My nan being able to keep up to date with me by watching me on TV. What other job in the world would give you that? That's really special. And obviously all my family that watch and love it. And that feedback you get. You can't do this job and be a journalist and be a reporter and be on TV without really wanting and appreciating the feedback you get. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about caring what people think as well.
Because there is something, isn't there, that if you're doing something on TV, who is the audience? Do you have a person in mind who sort of represents the entire demographic, you know, is it, because Sarah Kennedy, who used to be on Radio 2, would always have in mind not necessarily a particular gender, not even a particular occupation, but somebody who was sort of like, she was talking to that one person. And I mean, Zoo Radio has sort of taken away some of that because you've got the person in the you know, in the studio with you who you can sort of sound off against. But when it's you and the camera, because obviously there are people in the gallery, but it's you and the camera, you know, is there a particular person, real or imagined, who you, maybe it's like the sort of person that you're doing this for, the person who you think is most going to get something out of what you're presenting?
It's funny that you've... I'm going to try that tonight when I present the show. I've never thought of that. No one's ever suggested that or said that, but that's a really key way of looking at it. I think I'm so making sure everything's okay, yeah, and making sure that I just deliver it. But I think that would help a lot in ways of... see, learning. I'm learning. I love learning. So I think that would help in ways of visualising your audience, and it would make you speak more like a human, I suppose. Be less news robot and be more, I'm telling you this story. It's a great idea.
Because I think it can be your future self, because I was thinking this, because I enjoy watching myself back, enjoy in inverted commas, because sometimes, you know, when
see,
I started...
I don't ever watch myself back.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because when I did the first one in August on Kent Tonight, the thing that really struck me, but wouldn't be of any surprise to anybody else, is how I was moving my arms around all the time. And I thought, I'm not like that. And I thought, well, I probably am, but I just don't know that I'm doing it. And actually what it made me do, particularly when I was presenting, is just to make sure that I was controlling that. And now I don't worry about it. And actually, you need to have some of that. I'm doing it now as I'm talking to you, but I'm not normally aware of it. And often it looks good because it shows that I'm you know, expressing myself.
Engaged.
But actually, it's funny because it's almost like, you know, I'm 50. It's almost like suddenly watching yourself through the eyes of other people. But for other people, they've already formed their own conclusion as to the sort of person that you are. They know it. But you don't see it yourself. And actually, it actually quite difficult sometimes to process, because you then realise that you have to somehow almost go against the grain and, you know, go on the programme, talk about these things in a short time, but also just be aware of exactly where you put your hand, whether you are speaking in a sufficiently sombre way if you're talking about a serious story, or you're lighting up but not to the degree that it feels a little bit too over the top. It's effectively knowing the dynamics of the room.
I'm also very jealous of news programs that broadcast all day, or breakfast shows that have a really long time, because they have space and time to ad lib, to joke with the person presenting next to them, to move on to this, to add this. Our shows, they're once a day and they're compact, so we try and get a lot into one show. And there's room for ad libbing, but obviously we are on a countdown clock and we can't crash the show. So it's trying to be funny, witty, yourself, relaxed and calm in a timed, controlled news environment.
Spontaneous and structured.
Yes, it's like spontaneous, fun news delivery. I love it. I love the challenge. And that's why when you get those moments where you're like, oh, I did that link really well, or I ad-libbed that weather really well. Like, you come from a report that was looking really miserable and raining, you say, well, it looked like that reporter didn't have much fun in the rain there. Well, let's see if the rest of our reporters will be the rest of the week. And sometimes you can say that, sometimes you just forget all words.
And actually, to be fair, because I've noticed that when you and the other presenters are doing the weather, you are actually ad-libbing it, that you've got the map of Kent, and you're then effectively making sure that you accommodate all the different parts of the county. And, you know, you're not reading a script in that sense. And that's a real skill, because you're doing it in the timed conditions. And occasionally, I won't mention any particular names, but one of your fellow presenters was sitting in front of the monitor when Sophia was presenting the other week, and she was having to tell him to move, but he didn't see her. And yet, if you'd listened to it, or, you know, watched the programme, you wouldn't have known that was going on. But to be in the studio and to sort of see that happen live actually was quite phenomenal. So it all fitted together, even though, goodness knows what must have been going through in that case, Sophia's head.
Those moments of the quick changeovers. I mean, we could talk forever about little moments of things that have gone wrong but are just hilarious to us now, really funny. You know, so me and Bartholomew often, we both, if one of us starts laughing, that's it, the other one's done. And so, like, we'll do our sports chat. He does all the sports, so I'll be asking him about sports, and there might be a funny camera angle or something that makes us giggle, and then we've got to try and do the rest. But in those moments, it's about going, well, everyone, you saw that go really wrong, we'll try and move on now, but that was hilarious. And rather than going, okay, next tonight, and moving on really super seriously, it is really hard to do when you're thinking, I've got to be myself, but I've got to deliver this news, but I've got to address the big issue, the big elephant in the room when that went wrong.
You see, that's the joy of doing it live, because it's like giving a lecture live as opposed to a pre-recorded one. But often, I used to find with radio growing up, that it was when the presenters would have handovers, you know, 30 seconds or a minute, you know, on Radio 2, you know, you'd have Terry Wogan, Ken Bruce, but, you know, that classic thing, when it was spontaneous, and sometimes it would just be inane, but that was the real humanity, because that was where, and you knew that they hadn't planned this in advance, it was just literally just, you know, making conversation, but also that was what connected with the audience, because it showed that they were real, you know, because otherwise you'd have a CD on, you wouldn't listen to the radio, you'd just sort of put on what you want. The fact you've got radio means that there has to be that, you know, talking over the music or whatever, is kind of what you get out of radio. If you don't like that, then radio isn't, it probably isn't the right medium for you.
It, yeah, I think things like when it does go wrong and when moments happen, it's as much as we can laugh about it in hindsight, for sure, in the moment it's the worst thing that's ever happened. You know, I'm live and they're changing the plans or the buttons aren't working, so I'm queuing something up. Oh, and we're about to play you this report, and the report's not there. And it's about what you do in that moment and being frank. In that moment, it's bad. Once it's over, it's bad, and oh, that show was ruined. After, you watch it back, and it's hilarious, and you put it in the vault, and you play it to wind each other up. You know, you have to just let go. You have to say, well, I couldn't control that. I didn't have control over that going wrong, and that's fine. Look back at it and go, next time. But it is hard when you put your heart and soul into a show and it goes wrong when you're training people up and wrong buttons are pressed. That's really disheartening, of course. But it's about just keep going.
But it can bring out the best in you, because I found that if I'd much rather stand in front of a class of students and do it live, and sometimes if something goes a bit wrong, you know that you can sort it out. You sort of know what needs to happen to show that you're in control, or to show, or just to actually say, everything's all right, don't worry. Mm. If I'm sitting in the audience, if I'm a student, and I want to ask a question, I might have, if I'm lucky, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, I've got to catch the eye of the presenter, of the lecturer. And if I say something stupid, and I'm more likely than not to say something silly, I'm going to, you know, effectively say something because I'm thinking of it, so I've got my 10 seconds and I'm just going to fluff it. But if I'm presenting something, it doesn't matter because I've got multiple opportunities to correct that. So I sometimes wonder, and somebody was at work saying to me that I'm more of an extrovert than I realised I was, because I need to have that kind of sort of almost performance element rather than be the person anonymously in the background. You know, in other words, rather than sit in the... And if I was sitting in a studio, in an audience, the thought of going on TV would be terrifying. Mm. But if I'm doing it, there's nothing better. I would never want to then step back into the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I suppose it comes down to the phrase as well, like centre of attention, and how that was always, and it still is, like, such a negative thing. Someone's got to be at the centre. Someone's got to be on your screen giving you the news, or presenting your comedy show, or presenting the quiz show, or starring in a drama. Someone is always the centre of attention in what you're watching or consuming, if we're particularly just talking about. I think if it's done in a positive way, in a way that they enjoy and the audience loves, it's not a problem. But that was always something that was said to me. Like if I'm in a room full of people, I will always try and be the funniest. Whether I am or not is subjective, but I will always try and be funny and crack a few jokes and be sarcastic and stuff like that, because I enjoy the feedback of visually seeing people happy, finding a joke funny or enjoying that. I always, growing up, I didn't have loads and loads of friends. I have one best friend who is just my best friend, and that's it. We have a joke that we think it's really hilarious that we're adults, but we call each other best friends, and we're just obsessed with it. And we get, like, jokingly but seriously jealous when we talk about other people we've been around. Like, I was with her the other day, and we're like, what? So we have that, and I mean, that is something else, because I've just her as my friend, but growing up I was always with adults, always with older people, always enjoyed that, the company of, like, my parents' friends and older people, and yeah, I was just probably older than I was at different ages. You know, I was really, like, on it with school, learning, always trying to do more and do better and do things, and I had fun and I went and did crazy things as any young person would. But yeah, I was very much like, I need to learn, I need to do more, I can't be in trouble, I can't be told off. Never had a detention, never anything like that. I was just so, like, teacher's pet. Like, yeah. Loved impressing the teacher, loved working really hard, loved showing off what I've done and being the best. And that also comes from worrying what people think.
But that's the model, though, isn't it? Because, I got through school in a similar way. And I, you know, even now, I mean, nobody makes me go into work every day, as in, if I'm not teaching, then there's no expectation that I'm there. But I thought, well, where else would I want to be? Because it's like going to the centre of gravity in that sense. You know, lockdown for me was awful because there was that sense of being quite remote. Of, you know, I was engaging with people on social media. I actually developed quite a lot of skills that are quite useful for the TV work because I'd be teaching students who wouldn't be appearing on a screen, and I would just be watching myself because I was the only person on the screen. Yeah. So I was watching myself thinking, so this is how I come across, or this is what the students are seeing. So I was much more aware of my own appearance, but it's just the head in those days rather than the full body shot. But something that I always ask in the podcast, not about film, because obviously we've done the film programme and anybody listening to this can watch that if they like, but music growing up. Because for me, I was from an era where it was the charts. It was on a Sunday. We'd all listen to the radio, of course, in our own respective spaces. Mm-hmm. Then in the playground the next morning, we'd all be talking about whether our favourite song was in the top 10 or even number one. Quite almost risible from the point of view of today, because that just isn't what goes on. My children have no comprehension of that. But is that something that when you were growing up, were there particular artists, bands, gigs, anything like that, radio even, that had an influence on you?
So growing up, radio was, we didn't really listen to it. We didn't really like engage with that kind of thing. Like, I couldn't really tell you some of our classic radio hosts. It's terrible. But like that's not something I grew up with at all, really. Music, I would say, it's very strange because I grew up not knowing really like, you know, everybody raves and still does about like Arctic Monkeys. I never knew who they were until I was 21. But growing up, we would listen to things like The Feeling or The Wombats. That would be stuff that's more from my dad. But the main thing from a very young age would be just like dance music, like clubbing music, because my mum and dad were obsessed with that. Like growing up, that's where they met. They met in a nightclub, my mum and dad. My mum walked up to my dad and said, "Oh, you look nice," and then that was it. And in fact, that's how I met my boyfriend as well. We went in the nightclub as well, so that, I love how that sort of transcends. But
The frightening thought is that your parents are probably younger than me, because that whatever that you're describing there is exactly the sort of thing that in the 90s was
kind of
big.
My dad's 50 now, so they met in a nightclub, so their music is that. My mum now goes on her own like to these like Stern's reunions and clubbing events, and on her own just because she loves music. She won't drink but she'll just be there and just love the music. My dad loves anything with a good beat to it, and we can learn the lyrics. But then I have this wonderful weirdness of my stepmom who just likes all sorts of, you know, it's Italian opera and then it's like some grime music and she's singing Stormzy and rapping. So we have this like completely random, we'll just get in the car and anyone will put on anything. And that was sort of always it. There wasn't these particular artists and the particular things. There are songs that I remember growing up to and that really, like, I hear it and I mean a lot. One song I always think is Summertime. And me and my dad know every word. And we hear that song and it's like, you know, you have songs that relate to people and stuff. So I have that with loads of people and I connect songs to certain people. Growing up, I went to a Neil Diamond concert with my mum and dad and brother.
I've been to see Neil Diamond in concert. And one of my recent interviewees has literally travelled the world. She goes to Australia. Well, because I think she went to Australia to see Neil Diamond. And it was around the time that he was diagnosed with Parkinson's and stopped performing. But I said, I've been to the O2 thinking, you know, hey, look at me. And she was like, no, she's been to America, she's been to everywhere. New York, everywhere. So well, yeah, Neil Diamond.
Yeah, not quite that commitment, but we went to it when we were much younger. And there are certain songs that recently me and my mum sung at a karaoke together. And I've never done karaoke in my life, but I was second up, completely sober, stood up.
And which one did you do?
Well, to start, I started with Eminem, The Real Slim Shady. Yeah, that was brave. So I did that in front of a whole pub full of people. And that I was nervous for and embarrassed. I can do the TV, I can do the interview, I can do all the awkward questions and all that. But that I was like, just pretend. Abby, just go for it. And that's the thing, you can't half do that. You have to give it everything. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just really embarrassing otherwise. And I did. And everyone, and it was just funny. And that's all you wanted. I wanted everyone to laugh and have fun and not feel awkward. And that's, everyone laughed. All my family laughed, so everybody else got involved. And it was such good fun. And then me and my mum stood up and we did Blue Jeans. And, yeah, we did a couple of Neil Diamond songs. And, yeah, that was special because that was, you know, me and my mum, and the song that we've, like, songs we've listened to growing up. But it's weird, the influence of music in my family, I think, is different to others. When I was much younger, I had like a boyfriend when I was sort of up until 16 for a few years, and I was really, really close with his family. We spent a lot of my time there. I'd say, like, a lot of my childhood was spent there, like my sort of early teens was spent there up to 16, and they absolutely loved Foo Fighters and I can't think of that. Oh, the indie music they were like obsessed with. So I grew up listening to that with them, which was really cool, and I loved that. And they were such a musical family. You'd be sitting there every evening, one would get out a guitar, one would get out the piano, and that I grew up with, which was so different to my family, and then so different to others.
Because music was territorial. When I was at school, you know, you'd have the people who were really into the heavy metal or Bon Jovi, or people who would... my stuff was always much more chart-based, so that was always seen to be a bit, you know, it was sort of cool in the wrong way. It was the sort of stuff that was so mainstream that therefore if you were a real, you know, you'd have to go the extra mile.
Yeah, it wasn't so much of a personality.
But there were record shops that you'd go to that would really specialise. There was one in Cardiff called Spillers. And, you know, the number of people who wanted to work there, I think, you know, there was, you know, hundreds would be applying for a job there just because they had access to the sort of music that you wouldn't get on, in those days, mainstream radio stations. So in that sense, there was something very territorial. One thing I've noticed in later years is that some of that sort of stuff at the time that people might be a bit sneering towards, kind of people admit this, because it's easy when you're in your 50s and 60s to sort of say, well, actually, I kind of liked it more than I could ever admit. I was interviewing one colleague at work and who kept talking about this music from 1982, Goombay Dance Band and so on. And it was the sort of stuff that was, as he put it, post-Boney M. And it was at the time, people, and it made number one, but it was like, oh, this is rubbish. However, all those decades on, he's like, if that comes on, this is the test. If it comes on the radio, do you switch it down, turn it up, keep it the same? And he said, yeah, I turned it up. And that was exactly it.
Yeah.
And so it's almost that sense that you can almost, you mean, Neil Diamond went through a period in the 90s of being a little less cool. And then he sort of made this huge resurgence. But it's kind of nice to say, no, I was with Neil all the way through. At the end of the day, that's the authentic voice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange. His music, I remember thinking this as well growing up, that a lot of families, music is like at their core. Like, they'll sit down, they'll turn on the radio, they'll have the radio on, they'll have the band on, they'll go to see the band, they'll all sing their favourite songs from it. But mine was just this indifferent, weird and wonderful mix of loads of different things. I did a lot of camping growing up, and still now, it was all I knew. I thought everybody went camping, and that was like the thing. Like, my dad would pick me up from school and we'd go straight camping every weekend. Like, that was it, come rain or shine, camping. Even recently, me and my dad went on a 10-day tour of Europe just because we were like, oh, I've got this time off work, let's go. And we had no plan, and we went, and we just camped, stayed in a couple of hotels, and then camped again. Barbecue stuff, but that was it. So it'd be like we had a fire at the campsite and just sitting around and a bit of music, a lot of games like we used to play. I remember always playing like different games. So we'd play like the celebrity name game, and you'd go around and you might say, I don't know, Neil Diamond, and then you would then have to say a name beginning with the
last letter. I did that with my children.
So, Neil Diamond.
So, Duran Duran, then you'd say, or something like that.
Yeah, or like Danny Dyer. See, if you said that to me, I could then, it would then swap the direction, then I'd come back with Danny Dyer. And then basically, if you do double letters, it goes the other way. And the M's are great, because apparently we include Mickey and Minnie Mouse. So we're back and forth. So, like, things like that have really stuck around as well, and like that sort of thing. But I would say we just have this wonderful mix of whatever you want to listen to goes. But nowadays, like more recently, since the last decade when my stepmom's been in our life, that music is weird and wonderful as well. She'll just put on whatever.
Yeah, and as we start to wrap up, because obviously nostalgia is framing this conversation, what do you do? You actually talked about this very openly, actually, in the film programme in relation to your mum and her brain injury. But when something happens that is just so difficult to process, challenging, it seems pat to sort of say, can you be nostalgic about it? But sometimes I found that things that are awful when they happen suddenly lead to all sorts of unexpected routes, possibilities, maybe the renewal of friendships, sort of, you know, reconnecting with people from your past. But, you know, you went through something that sounded awful, and it was one of the films that you chose related very much to what happened in your mum's case.
Without realising.
Without realising, that's the thing as well. So it's how we process all of those.
Yeah.
And often they happen at a subliminal, almost like invisible level. But you know, can you be nostalgic about those sort of things that are at the time really quite negative?
Yeah. I think one example that does come to mind is I was with someone more recently in my life, so from about 17 to 21, 16 to 20, I was with someone for 4 years, and that ended very suddenly, very shocking. And I was completely infatuated. That was a huge part of my life. A lot of it was travelling. What they did for a job meant they were up and down the country and around the world racing motorbikes. So that was a huge part of my life. That ended very suddenly, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. I've never felt that heartbreak, and it was very, very sharp and cutting. It just happened, and that was it. We never spoke again. Very, very cut and dry. That's the way I like things. If it's I'm all or nothing, so that's the way I wanted it. That was it. Me done. Fine. But it hurt. It was absolutely heartbreaking. And my partner, now that we live together now, the way I look back at that point, I look back at it quite a lot. Not in a way of, oh, I missed that, I wish I was there. But I look back at it like, I'm so grateful, and I don't regret it at all. I don't regret any of that time, because it taught me so much about myself. And my stepmom said one lovely thing to me that stuck with me since. She said, you learn how to love someone when they didn't give you anything back. And she said, how amazing is that you can do that? And I thought, yeah, I thought I need to take that with me. But I look back at it like, if that didn't happen to me, I would not appreciate what I have now with who I have now. I would not appreciate him. I wouldn't see it for what it is and realise how lucky I am now and how much happier I am and stable and a future, and whatever will be from now. I'm not scared. I'm not attached in a negative way, that if this was what I'm in now, the relationship I'm out, if that was to end, I would be heartbroken even more so. But it wouldn't be the end of everything, because one, it's less likely to happen, but it's also that like understanding of myself, selfishly talking, understanding of myself, what I want, what I need, and leaving something that wasn't right and shouldn't have been for so long, but I don't regret it, because it taught me so much.
Yeah, I had an interesting experience well into my 40s where somebody came into my life and it was like, wow, this is incredible, this is amazing, and then pretty much disappeared. And actually it took years, far longer than the time I knew that person, actually, to try and process that, because it was like all these expectations. But what I did during mourning. Yeah, it is mourning, and because you're grieving for someone who's still alive, but effectively they might as well be dead, because their relation to you, you know, in 100%. A way, if they were dead, there would actually be a
exactly
sense of which
you know where
you can put them.
It's final.
It
feels like it's final, but it was still like open, and I was left confused and not understanding. And it's really, really hard to explain to anyone what a profound effect that has. I don't think there's this like stigma and misconception and like thing about when you break up with someone, if someone breaks up with you, it's, oh, that's a shame, that's really sad. Okay, it's not seen as a, is it? I think the only time it's seen as something as serious as someone passing away or something really tragic happening is when it's like a divorce or something. And I completely understand that, because children are involved, maybe you've bought a house together. There are a lot more at stake, especially when you've been together a long time. But I think when you are 20 years old and that happens to you, it can really rock you, especially because 16 to 20, a lot changes in your life. You are, that is in the years of a teenager, that's a, what, nearly a quarter of your teenage life? A lot happened, a lot changed. That's the years where you're sort of moulded into this young adult you become. And all of that was with that one person in this very strange environment where I was travelling all the time up and down the country at racetracks and a little bit in someone's shadow, you know, because they were well known, they were known in what they did, people would recognise them on the street. And it was very strange, and all of it, understanding why I was in this world, what I need to put, what I should put up with, what this is just what it is, this is how it is, just deal with it. And then that done. I'm free. I can do the things I want to do now, and I can be who I want to be. But that was decided for me.
Yeah.
Very strange.
There is that thing of what may not at the time appear to be second chances, but which, when they happen, you suddenly... I mean, to a large extent, that's what happened with me, I suppose. I mean, you know, I see an awful lot of films. Now, I used to do that when I was younger. I mean, I never watched films. When I was at school, that was never my thing. University is when I started to... And I ended up, you know, almost like going from not watching anything to watching loads and then doing turning it into like a research project, an academic project. So, you know, if I watch a film, I write a review of it. But a lot of that... You know, which I do now, I couldn't have done if my life had moved in a different, more, should we say, the direction that perhaps I wanted or expected it to.
Yeah.
So actually, I do quite quirky things, but I didn't always have the chance to do those. And I think, well, this is me. And actually, it's harder for something really bad to happen because you've got things that you know you can fall back on, the things that define you. Because if that... like that other person is your world, if that person disappears from it, then everything else crumbles. So I think it's also a form of protection that, you know, some, you can lose a job, you can lose a relationship, you can lose somebody through a death, but having other things that kind of ground you and anchor you, which, you know, on paper sound the most debilitating things possible. So in a funny way, there are certain things that become positives, but that doesn't mean that they were okay. It doesn't justify what happened, but it means that the lens through which you see them has changed.
And it helps you learn from it and live with it and grow from it, because you can't change the bad thing that happened. You can never change it, but it's how you then adapt and you change in a positive way from that. I would not appreciate what I have now without going through that. And I was very assertive and certain to never lose myself within a relationship, and I don't think I ever did, but it was such a critical and crucial time to who I became. If I followed someone's shadow for the rest of my life, or I made my own thing, I become a TV presenter and I become an assistant news editor. So I think that was that critical time and that critical moment where it was like, no, it really is me now, and I can't, and I'm not being held back. I am my own, you know, my own entity. I'm not in anyone's shadow anymore.
But I've got two more questions, and one of them actually builds directly on that, which is that, do you think that you could be doing what you're doing now if the things that you've just described hadn't happened? In other words, do you think that you're doing what you're doing now almost as a way of recalibrating who Abby is, in that sense of saying, okay, that you're doing things now because you want to do them, because you can do them, because you're empowered to do them, whereas perhaps you wouldn't have had... It's not even a confidence thing. It's almost like you, because you may be defined by a different force or a different person that wouldn't give you that freedom of expression.
I would like to say it would have never changed me following whatever path I wanted to go to, but I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know if it would. But I would say that I'm so strong-minded and strong-willed. That's why I say I'm going to do something, I'll do it. Like, I can't fight that internal battle with myself. I'm arguing with myself and that, well, you said you're going to do it, so you've got to. You know, so I wouldn't have let myself just dull and not follow any kind of dream, but I would have adapted whatever dream I had to, oh, I really want to do this. And is it because I want to do that, or is it because it's the situation I'm in and that's the easiest route?
You have a very strong sense of self, I think.
Yeah.
That,
you know, I would have at the time gone, I could see myself going, oh, I really want to do this job. I'm going to apply for this, but I'm perhaps settling for that job or just convincing myself that that job's amazing because it works for everything else that's currently going on. Whereas now I'm in this relationship, and if the job I want is all the way up north, all the way in another country, across the world, I would go for it. I wouldn't not do it because I know I'm so secure and fine in what is meant to happen, that I know it's going to be fine, that doesn't scare me, that I have this just like, I'm not going to dull any sparkle I have, you know. I'm going to put myself first in that sense because I have the trust and the faith in the relationship I'm in being absolutely fine, if we're talking particularly about relationships. Then another thing I always say is a huge part of me and things I say and when I'm trying to overcome something or look back on something is, it was meant to be. If it's going to be, it will be. And I almost laugh when I say that because, one, it's so cliche, but that's exactly why I laugh, because my best friend always said it to Abby, it's meant to be. Abby, it's meant to be. And I would always laugh at her, and I'd always laugh at her, but she's instilled that in me. And so, you know, when I haven't spoken to her in a little while, or we're far away, or like, she's still with me because I'm still thinking, it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And I always think that. I sit there and I think that if that is going to happen, it will happen, and it was always going to happen that way. There are things that change along the way, and that outcome will always change, but that was what was always going to happen. So it doesn't... I try not to worry about it. And I think someone once said to me that if you're worrying about something happening or doing something, there's no point worrying about it, because then you're putting yourself through it twice. You're worrying about the thing, and then when you do the thing, you're going through it again. So you can't control it. And often, me and my dad both struggle with that sense of like anxiety and the overthinking. And he says, it's never as bad as you think it's going to be, and it never is.
Yeah, no, that's true. Very wise words, as a fellow 50-year-old. Yeah. My very last question, Abby, is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person.
Wow, that is a really, really hard question. I feel like it's looking forward.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the first thing that comes into my mind. I think it's looking forward without forgetting the past. I think it's remembering all those things, because you can take for granted what you have now, but then I think, back then, I would have killed for this now, you know?
Yeah, it'd be interesting if you were asked that question in, say, 20 years' time, and what answer you might give. Because I think often that's a very relative and sort of perspectival kind of question.
Yeah.
It's not like there is one definitive answer. Yeah. It's more of a lens that is particularly useful for you at this moment.
I have a huge sort of fear of failure. I have a huge, like, I really don't want to fail. I don't want to let anyone down, but I also really just want to keep going and make the most of everything and do it right and do it well. I have this huge, you can't fail, you can't fail. And I always, always think, and I always say it to people, that when I'm 30 in 8 years' time, when I'm 40 in 18 years' time, I'm going to sit back and go, why was I 22 and worrying about that? What a waste of the start of my 20s. And I always think about that future version of me and what I want them to say and think. And do I want 30-year-old me to go, why did you worry about that? Sometimes I wish I could have a little glimpse into the future to know I'm going to be all right. Yeah. Okay, I can relax now.
Yeah.
Instead of this fear that it could all come crashing down. I think that's what keeps you going. It keeps you on your toes, and it keeps that energy, the first question you asked me, up.
And I'm sure also that links with all the reason I watch the films that I do, because sometimes I see templates, glimpses, almost like, if I was in that position, that maybe is what I would do. You know, maybe not in the same way, but it kind of gives you possibilities.
Yeah.
Abby, it has been fantastic
to chat to you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for being my guest this week.